So with that, that'll bring us to our first of two significant business items. Item five, which is a report on our liquidity sub-portfolio. I see Mr. Price is now joining us. We will first in 5A, we will do a staff presentation, and then as 5B, we will hear from SIT Investment Associates. So there's Mitch, I see you joining us, all right. So Tim, item five, liquidity sub-portfolio, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we could have, Mitch, if you could bring up the presentation on the screen share while I kind of kick it off here. This is our annual review of the liquidity sub-portfolio. I will say this is kind of a little bit more interesting review period than we typically have. The liquidity portfolio tends to be our quiet, get it done, no surprises portfolio. It still is, but I think the market conditions surrounding it are quite noteworthy. And I think you're going to see the theme over the next couple of agenda items of how interest rate moves are impacting our liquidity sub-portfolio, the broader fixed income market. We're going to be joined by Bryce Doty of SIT to both comment on his portfolio, which is one of the liquidity sub-portfolios, and give us a little bit of his insight into Fed movement. And then we're going to have Varis join us and talk about how interest rates move beyond fixed income and ripple through the rest of the portfolio. So I think it's interesting from my perspective. I'll be curious to know what the trustee reactions are, but I think we've got a little bit more to share than we typically do on this topic. So if we go to slide two, Mitch.
These are interesting times, Tim.
They are interesting times.
You can put it that way.
And so I'm going to go over kind of the structural role. This is the I'm going to go through fairly quickly. There's no new information there, and just a reminder of how this fits in our portfolio. I'm going to hand it off to Mitch to give a little bit more insight into the manager structure, manager performance, and the market conditions around that. And then I'll wrap it up with a little bit of a review process here. But while we're on slide three, let's go ahead and just do the reminder here. Under the FFP portfolio construction process, we try to keep long-term assets invested long-term and have short-term assets fund short-term liabilities. So the liquidity portfolio is really how we fund. It was 4 years of benefit payments. Now with the 2020 revision, it's 3 years of benefit payments. So we have taken care of that short-term liquidity need, and the growth portfolio is set up to, when appropriate, take much longer term risks to try to get a maximum rate of return there. And that includes private markets and more volatile securities where we want to be, not forced into selling those. We want to be hold them through volatility. So this is what allows us to capture some of those long-term opportunities. And if we go to slide four, Mitch. So the liquidity sub-portfolio really is the cornerstone that allows this portfolio construction process to work. A couple of comments on this slide. I think we've been running this program for about 5 years now. It does play to our strengths as a public pension fund in that we have very, very predictable liabilities, predictable benefit payments. We use actuarial projections running out 5 years and try to match a model to it. We're typically within $500,000 the model is within $500,000 of matching actual benefit payments. I think we're running at right about $46 million a month now. So all of those benefits are locked in, they are secured. There's not a lot of volatility in this portfolio. And it's just meant to be kind of that slow and steady portfolio of certainty. And, I think it is worth noting that the fourth bullet point there, we're largely reliant upon maturing debt and trading kind of in that order to make the benefit payments. And so we are somewhat insulated against interest rate moves. We'll see mark-to-market volatility. But if we bought a bond 3 years ago and we're holding it until it pays off and then we're using that cash to fund a benefit payment, the mark-to-market volatility doesn't get manifested necessarily until we get to the very end of it there. The contractual income part is what we're starting to build into now that we've got the portfolio stood up, functioning. We've increased our confidence that the actuarial models are sound and reliable. Now we're starting to map over more contractual income from other parts of the portfolio, notably some of the other fixed income strategies. But we're also exploring potentially mapping over some contractual real estate income to the extent we start to do more operating-oriented cash flow, operating-oriented real estate rather than development. So more to come on that one in the next year or so, but things are working as we expect there. With that, I'm going to hand it off to Mitch to talk about how we put the managers together, what they each bring to the table, and how they're navigating the markets here.
All right.
Mitch, you're on mute.
Yeah, I was going to say, I couldn't find him on my thing. There he is. You're still on mute, Mitch.
Okay, I'll get this. All right, thank you. Thank you for your patience. As Tim mentioned, the big change was really the reduction of 1 year of benefits, right? But the other thing we did when we looked at the portfolio, we said, how could we optimize this? So we changed the lineup a little bit, not hugely. But if you look at where we were a year ago, we were at SIT was 25%, DFA was 25%, and Insight was 50%. And we moved those to the new numbers you see there, 40, 22, and 38. That kind of optimized correlations and returns for us. So it's beneficial to us. And if you look at the chart on the right, you'll see what looks a little odd is that Insight has a huge contribution this year to our benefit payments. And that's really driven by the fact that we're right-sizing it from 50% down to 38. So that's not a whole lot of change on this. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is really, it has been a very unusual year. So we're going to the beginning of this year has been unusual. Last year was pretty sleepy when you look at the totals, but there's a lot of volatility inside that. So we want to talk about the first quarter quite a bit today and how that's driving, how the macro has changed, how policy has changed, and how that's driving returns. The first thing you need to know about this is that it's a very defensive portfolio. And that's what it has to be. And how does it become defensive? First, credit quality. This is the highest credit quality. So if there's a recession or a downturn, all these issuers are going to pay their debts pretty much across the board. The next thing, which is less understood but super important, is duration. And this is a short duration portfolio. And what that means is it is not sensitive to interest rates. And if you look at that chart on the right, you'll see duration 2.1, 2.9. The average for the portfolio is about 2. And what that means is the sensitivity is 2. So if rates go up by 1%, this portfolio's value will go down by 2%. That's what a duration of 2 equals. So it's an important concept to keep in mind. It applies to really all assets. It's basically a fixed income concept, but it applies across the board. This is why you hear growth stocks have gone down so much, because they have higher duration. Their payments are out in the future. They're highly discounted. So yesterday, we officially entered a bear market with NASDAQ. It was down 20% on the year. That's contrasted to a less growthy or lower duration index in the S&P, which is down about 12%. So what's changed here over the year, over 21, is that we went up a little bit in credit quality, and we pretty much stayed the same in duration. Moving to the individual components. So SIT is a unique asset class. It's 95% mortgage-backed securities. They're AAA, the super high credit quality. They do have an issue with extension risk, and duration can move because they're mortgages. Over the period of the year, SIT reduced its duration from 2.9 to 2.0, and the credit quality was unchanged. DFA moved in the other direction. They increased credit quality and increased duration. Now, this is unusual. DFA and Insights, keep in mind, they're very similar assets. They're basically corporate credit, very high quality U.S. companies that issue bonds. However, they take a very different approach. DFA is very much a technically based type approach that they look at credit curves, they look at credit spreads and make the decision based on that. Whereas Insight, same kind of assets, but they're very bottom up. They look at individual companies, they do fundamental analysis. What's interesting and what drove our change from that original lineup of 25, 25, 50 to the current one is because these two aren't correlated. They have lower correlation than you'd expect considering the asset class. And it's really about how they approach their portfolios. So in summary, DFA, increased credit quality and increased duration. So more sensitive to rates. Insight kept their credit quality pretty much the same, but lowered their duration. And they lowered it by a significant amount, went from 1.6 to 1.3, somewhat significant. So that's really the overview of our three managers performing very well and as expected. As Tim mentioned, we have like really Insight runs on maturities. So as bonds mature and they pay off, that funds us. And then to just skip back to SIT, if you think about mortgages, they're basically self-liquidating. They pay you principal and interest, and at some point they mature. So given the way SIT constructs their portfolio, it's very well suited to our benefit payment stream. And then moving to the next, providing benefits, you know, this has been an interesting kind of journey to keep track of what Siegel comes up with, what our internal intelligence is from our retirement services and our own projections and our adjustments. And it's been very close. I mean, we have been within 50 basis points up or down over the last 2 years. So I think this is pretty self-explanatory. We will be topping off this July. And we keep a pretty close look at it. We're pretty much review every couple months where we are. Now, here's kind of the heart of the matter. It's a very different year. We have inflation now that we haven't seen in 40 years. And that's causing a policy change, and that's causing asset valuations to change. So if we think about where we've been this year, as of 3/31, the 10-year bond was down 5.5%. Now that's like the safest asset you can have, right? But why is it down 5.5%? Because its duration is very high, right? It's very sensitive to rates. So that is, we haven't had anything like that since 1980, when it was very similar and inflation was close to 15%. So if we think about how the Fed's going to react to this, we definitely have inflation. Well, the Fed has a dual mandate. They have stable employment and price stability. And unemployment is back to where it was before the pandemic. So that's done. Inflation, on the other hand, and this is the Fed's measurement, PCE, went from about 1.5 a year ago, and it's now 5.4. And it's for a variety of reasons. We obviously have been following the COVID and Ukraine supply chain disruptions. And there's been a huge amount of fiscal and monetary policy accommodation. So now we're staring down kind of a change in the Fed's actions. We're going to look at a series of hikes. We've already had one hike. We're looking at potentially 9 or 10 by this time next year. And that's predicted by markets where Fed futures are traded. And that gets us to about 2.75 or 3% by February of 2023. And why is all that important? Well, because that rate is the first step in valuing every asset and discounting every cash flow. So you start with that 3% rate, then you add some kind of risk adjustment to it, and you discount whatever the asset is by that. So, you know, if you have something like an equity risk premium at 4.5%, and you had the risk-free rate at 0 a year ago, well, now you're going from 4.5% to something like 7 or 8%. And that asset is going to be worth less. That's just the way the math works. And it's just something we have to be aware of. And certain assets are more susceptible and sensitive to this than others. So here is the situation in pictures. The unemployment line is the bright green line. And you can see the big spike in COVID. Now it's back to 3.6, mission accomplished. The two red lines are really the red line and the magenta line are inflation. And inflation comes in a variety of flavors and a variety of variables are attached to them. First, if you think about headline inflation, that's what everyone experiences. And that's no components are removed. Everything that's volatile, like food and energy, is included. And this is how Social Security adjusts COLAs, et cetera. Headline CPI. And CPI is different than PCE. CPI is really, it has more of a shelter component in it. And it's more what it's what households actually experience. So again, headline CPI used by Social Security for COLAs, PCE, on the other hand, is used by the Federal Reserve. PCE is less volatile. It's based on surveys from businesses, and it has less of a shelter component. They also use core, so they exclude everything that's volatile. And therefore, you know, the really high-priced things that are moving around quickly, they're ignoring those for the time being. So what's been volatile? Well, commodities. If you take, everybody experiences prices filling up their gas tank, and this is what you experience day to day, all these commodity prices. But this is largely removed when the Fed looks at things. You can see there that the summary of this is that CPI headline is 2 full percentage points above core. And that's really driven by these commodities. And you can see a variety of commodities there on the right. Some are in this index and some aren't, but we're all experiencing those day to day. So how does the Fed deal with all this? Well, I'm going to get a little academic here and talk about this thing called the Taylor Rule, which is a way that central banks kind of inform their monetary policy. It's actually been used for close to 30 years. It's pretty intuitive. The formula may look a little complicated, but it's all just arithmetic. And it actually kind of works. We see, if you look at the graph, you can see the Taylor Rule in green and the Fed funds rate in blue, and they kind of match up. Now, the Fed's been using this since 93, and that's probably more indicative. If you look at 93 out, it follows a little more closely. So how do we think about this intuitively? Well, we think about it, if you look at the actual formula, it has two parenthetical pieces to it, and they're both gaps. They're both gaps in what we want and what we actually have. So if you think about the first one, that's the output gap. Now, if you turn your minds back to March of 2020, that number was the Y there was what the actual GDP was minus 3.4, and the target is 2. So we have a big negative number there. And if you go through all the math, that drives you down to about a negative 1%. So where were the Fed? They were at 0. So that works, right? The next piece is the inflation piece. And if you look at where we are today, that's the P minus P star. We're really at like 3.5 or 4%. Now, anybody can calculate this. And if you listen to the press, you'll find people like Larry Summers and Bill Dudley and other economists talking about how far behind the curve the Fed is. And if you do this calculation, you're going to agree. Even at their terminal rate right now, which is about 3%, they're behind. It should be about 3.5 if you use this formula.
Hey, Mitch, let me ask you a quick question. Is it fair to say the Taylor Rule is not a policy tool, but rather an analytic tool to tell you about something that has or hasn't occurred or whether some data is or isn't in conformance with it? In other words, it doesn't sound like it's a planning tool or a policy tool. It sounds like it's a explaining tool.
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know that I'm going to give the right answer, but my sense is that it is actually a policy tool. Now, I'm going to kind of caveat that with, like, you see those coefficients, 0.5, 0.5.
Yep.
The Fed will move those around. Different Fed governors and different Fed chairmen will move those around. The R star, they'll change that. It's an interpreted kind of formula. But you're going to hear, like, Janet Yellen spoke about this. Fed people talk about this. They use it. Now, the other thing about it is, getting to your point about the explaining, is that remember that whenever you do something in monetary policy, it takes 12 months at least for it to flow through the economy. So it's a moving target. There's lots of explaining you can do, Chairman. There's lots of explaining you can do. But this is a general formula. It's kind of a starting point, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess I was trying, you know, the lag seems to me to be embedded in all these things just for the reasons you just said, that you make a change, you tweak something here, and you have to wait quite a while to see what the outcome of that is.
Yeah, and I think that goes to, like, why include super volatile components when you don't know what they're going to do in a week, a month, a year. So, yeah, okay. I've been going through a lot. So if there's any other questions, I'm going to pause. I've been moving pretty fast. So
all I know is I'm old enough that they didn't teach the Taylor rule when I took econ, because I don't even know if Taylor was born by when I took econ. So,
yeah, a Stanford professor, I think he came up with it in the 90s. So this was not part of the Paul Volcker regime. Yeah. So you're right.
I predate that one too. So, okay. Any questions for Mitch before we move on? Let me see here. I'm not seeing any hands, so carry on.
Okay, so now I'm going to pound back onto the duration topic. This is the yield curve for U.S. Treasuries. Now, what's a yield curve? Well, on the vertical axis, you have rates. You know, and it goes from 0 to about 2.5%. So that's the 10-year rate, that's the rates across the terms, because the horizontal axis is the terms. So if you look at kind of, it says tenor, that's the other word that we use for terms. So tenor on the horizontal axis, you see 10-year, and you see that bright green line, you see how much the whole curve has shifted parallel and up and steepened on the short end of the curve. Well, it's steepened on the short end of the curve because that's where policy impacts the curve. That's where the Fed gets its juice and does what it does. It impacts that Fed funds rate, which is short term. And now we're going to look at that and we're going to do a little quick math. So the duration of a 10-year treasury turns out to be about 7.5. And if you look at the difference between the khaki line, which is 12/31/21, and the bright green line, which is the end of the quarter of the first quarter, you see about a 75 basis point change. Now, if the duration is, say, 7, and you had a 1% change, you'd get a 7% drop, but you didn't. You had about 3/4 of that. So if you do the math, you get to that 5.5% decline. So it's very easy to see. It's very clear in this picture. This is why the Treasury is down 5.5% on the year. So any questions about that? It's fairly dramatic. And you just don't see this stuff very often. So if you have any questions.
It feels pretty dramatic, actually. I'm not seeing it. I'm looking for hands here on my side gallery. So I don't see any hands of Mitch. So people are just completely understanding it. You've dazzled them, is my take on that.
Okay, great.
Just one other point on that one. In our liquidity program, because we have managers that do buy and maintain, they're going to have that price movement. They're going to have to mark to market on the price. But if they're not selling it, you're not locking in those losses there. So that's a little bit of the saving grace there.
Got it. Now that makes sense.
So this, a few caveats. This is a limited data set. This is from Bridgewater, the hedge fund in Connecticut. And the point here is not all inflationary cycles are equal. And different inflationary cycles affect different assets in different ways. And the other thing about it is, this is the past. It's a limited data set, goes back to the 1920s and covers basically US, Japan, and the UK. But one thing I can feel fairly certain about is if you look at TIPS, which is inflation protected securities, in stagflation, they're going to do well. And so that's kind of the way you look at this. This is the grid that these guys have come up with, which is really combinations of growth and inflation. So this is a very simple guide of some utility. And it's definitely something that we think about. Then kind of moving on to what the portfolio has done. And so what I want to highlight, and Tim is really great in pointing out the fact that if you don't sell your treasury bond, you don't take a loss, right? So if it matures in a year, you get your money back. And we have a short duration portfolio, so we don't have to realize these losses. But the point I want to make is year to date, look at those numbers at the top. Those are pretty, the investment grade bonds, muni bonds, treasuries, and mortgages are all part of what's called the Barclays Agg, which is something that people talk about all the time as an index that covers fixed income. All those numbers are down a lot.
Yeah.
Down a lot. And we're down 2.5 on the year to date and 2.6 for the full last 12 months. And then the other thing I want to point out is look at the numbers year to date. And they don't look so great, right? I agree. But look at DFA and Insight. They're very different, right? And so that shows you that the correlation is not there. There's less correlation between those two. So it's it shows the benefit of having managers that approach the market in diverse ways. Those numbers could be positive. You know, it could be DFA could be +2 and Insight could be -2. But in any case, the correlation is not there. And so the final thing I want to leave you with is all those numbers at the top, all those are driven by duration. We have a short duration portfolio, which is extremely defensive in volatile times like that. That's the way it should be. And it's well conceived and it's performing as expected. So with that, if there are any questions, I'll take them. And if not, we'll move on. Tim will wrap it up.
Okay, are there any questions of Mitch? I'm not seeing any hands up. So that's a good sign, Mitch. You as I say, you dazzled them. And I'm gonna ask Tim one question, but I'll wait till he does the wrap up. It's a general question.
I'll wrap up fairly quickly here. So just a couple more pieces on the mechanics to remind trustees about kind of the flow of the process here. Last year, we didn't do this refreshing because the board made the decision to lower the target from 4 years of benefit payments to 3 years. So we just allowed a natural runoff. But now we're going to be back into the refresh mode. We do this every July in conjunction with employer prepayments. It's a forced liquidity event. We're getting a large amount of money in. It's a natural time to do the true up and rebalancing. The time of year where we absolutely do this, the rest of the year we're monitoring for rebalancing opportunities. We will come back to the trustees with the annual funding plan in about 2 months. And that's basically going to look at the actuarial model and says, how much money do we need for that next incremental third year that we're going to have to refresh? And where are the yields in the market right now? So if we're going to go out and buy securities in today's market to fund those benefit payments 3 years out in the future, what's our discount rate? And that discount rate had been extremely small. So we've been paying up in the past. Now that yields have moved out, it's going to become a little bit more discounted. These aren't huge moves, but we will have a lower cost to build that new third year of benefit payments this July, assuming we stay on this interest rate path. If we go to 19, Mitch.
So actually on that question, I don't want to interrupt you, but I think it may be timely. Based on everything that you've gone over today, in terms of the returns, what the effect is in the liquidity portfolio, does the data that we've seen year to date and in the last 2 years suggest to you that a move to 2 years of benefits funding versus three would be problematic?
If we were to permanently lower? Right. You're asking?
Yeah. So I didn't really articulate that question very well. So we went from 4 years to 3 years in our most significant recent move. And my question is, if the board were to consider and decide it wanted to go to 2 years, has the experience of looking at this data and seeing what its effects are on the portfolio in terms of funding benefits in this snapshot of time, give you any pause about making that kind of a move?
That's a strategic decision, and we don't want to necessarily make that on a tactical basis. I think, we want to be cognizant that the 3 years was the long-term decision. Now, that said, if we were to reconsider that, and we typically do take a look at that in our asset liability studies every 3 to 5 years and move to 2 years, I don't think it's necessarily a problem. You have a little bit less insurance, but I think, if you trustees recall back to 2016 when we started this process, we did model out 2, 3, and 4 years of benefit payments. And so we said, the average downturn or the longest equity downturn over, I can't remember the time period we looked at, was, 21 months was roughly the longest downturn we'd have to kind of slog through. So, we could run this at 2 years. You have less wiggle room. But right. I mean, I think it's something that we certainly could take a look at. I wouldn't advocate taking a look at it at this point in time. I do think those tend to be more the strategic decisions. And, we just went through that process. So I'd probably kind of cue that up for the next time we go through a strategic review. I would say that we might do the next asset liability study on a little bit more frequent basis, given the volume of changes in the marketplace here. Particularly as we watch to see, how inflation gets resolved over the next year, how that ripples through, what European growth looks like, what the emerging markets look like. If the world changes, we need to reassess, and we do those little tweaks. And then, we will take a look at little tweaks next month when we take a look at the current capital market assumptions relative to our targets and see if we want to tweak changes. But I think, moving from 3 years to 2 years, that's more of the quote unquote, the big decision that we do less frequently.
Yeah. And I wasn't advocating, considering or advocating in any way, considering making a change based on this recent experience and this exploration of the data. I was just wondering if this data suggested anything to us about the ramifications on that kind of a decision, when and if it's appropriate for us to consider it. I mean, these are pretty extraordinary times. So I'm just trying to figure out if anything you're seeing that you and Mitch are seeing here, we talked about would give you pause or, really throw up some red flags about duration.
Yeah. A short answer is there's a lot moving here, but I don't think there's any red flags regarding our strategic decisions. I mean, if you think back to 2016, I know some of us, meaning me, were taking a look at this move to short and like, it's a strategic decision, but it also might be a timely decision if we have rising rates. Well, we did not have rising rates until very, very recently, but we took that duration out of the portfolio at that point in time. It did lessen our risk to a rising rate environment. We didn't have that rising rate environment for another 6 years. So I think we have to kind of step back and say, this one's strategic kind of regardless of market conditions. And then we might take some tactical positioning around that. And a lot of that's reliant upon the managers to make those moves on our behalf. But we can take a look at, doing some other things with the portfolio in extreme market environments. We're not in what I would consider an extreme market environment. We're in a stressed market environment right now. I would not advocate changes at this point in time.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. I was more interested in what the data were, kind of suggesting, or whether there were any embedded real serious red flags in there that would be guideposts. And it sounds like that's not a decision we can really discern, or it's not data that we can discern and make any decisions from, and it wouldn't be timely at this point.
It's not. And I mean, well, one quarter is dramatic and those moves are dramatic. One quarter does not a market make. And so we need to recognize that the strategic decisions need time to play out, but to the extent the world does change on us, and sometimes we get a little hyperbolic saying, you know, we're in an era of everything's changing and we're going to have deglobalization and this sort of thing. We might, but, you know, those things take time to play out. And we, you know, this is, you know, a very long-term portfolio. And so we want to be a little bit cautious not to overreact to short time period events here. So I think rates backing up feels very novel, given the last 15 years or so, but it is not terribly unique and, you know, in the long-term history of the economy. And certainly, you know, a terminal rate of 3% on the 10-year, that's in the long history of things, that's pretty normal. So, you know, it's going to feel like a bumpy path, but it's not historically abnormal.
All right.
All right, so I think we probably covered 19 here, but sorry.
Yeah, Tim, sorry, I just wanted a clarification. When it says that year-to-date we're down 2.5% on the liquidity portfolio, does that mean down 2.5% on paper? And since we hold on to the bonds, we're not really going to realize that much of a loss?
Yeah, that's on the market value. And so, you know, I don't want to be overly dismissive here. And I think it is on paper, but we do recognize it as a market value loss. But market value losses don't get locked in until you sell, right? It's so if we bought that bond, market value goes down, but we hold it to maturity, we're going to get our money back here. So we do have to recognize where the current market value is, and the fact that it's down 2.5% instead of, Mitch, what were those numbers, down 7 on the corporate side? And, you know, relative to what we'd had in the past and what's more standard of a core fixed income with more of a 5 to 6 year duration, we've got a lot of protection built in here. And the fact that we have a buy and maintain portfolio, it sets us up for a higher likelihood of recovery of the price of that security.
Okay. Yeah. That's helpful because some might think, well, you know, with rates going up, then why not do money market or cash or whatever? And I know that cash is subject to reduction in value from inflation and so forth. But if what we see is just basically on paper, and we hope to realize a better return, then that's reassuring.
Yeah. And I should stress, not every manager maintains that buy and maintain portfolio. But I think if you look at Insight, they explicitly adopt a buy and maintain portfolio. SIT kind of has less trading involved and tends to hold things longer. DFA is more the active trading to try to maximize the value of their positions. But across that portfolio, we've got the bulk of it in lower turnover, higher likelihood of you know, kind of maintaining to maturity type of strategies. So on slide 19, I think we've covered most of this. We've reduced, we review this every 3 to 5 years. Last in 2020, reduced it from 4 years of benefit payments to 3 years. And the board does always have the option of implementing this, you know, the zone 2, which kind of sounds like something big and somewhat exciting. But zone 2 rebalancing essentially is if we had an extreme market sell-off, equity market sell-off, the board could authorize, we take 1 year of the benefit payments and redeploy it into the equity markets. We really haven't gotten to those extremes. March of 2020 rebounded so quickly. We rebalanced within the portfolio, but we never really triggered this zone 2 piece here. But that is kind of the flexibility that's built into the investment policy statement.
Yeah, the zone 2 is a fancy term for buying opportunity, right?
It is absolutely a fancy term for buying opportunity. Yes.
Okay.
So slide 20, just a reminder that we did do that runoff portion with the emphasis on drawing down the Insight portfolio. So it had a smaller relative weight to the other two. And that was just kind of the normalization process. And now as we kind of get into the middle part of this year, you'll start to see the new normal behavior of what Mitch talked about with the roughly 40, 40-20 contributions from three portfolios there. 21, just wrap it up here. It, you know, I think this is kind of the time where the defensive nature of the way we construct the portfolio to protect our funded status gets a moment to shine. You know, we're down slightly, but that is much less than, you know, a more traditional duration fixed income portfolio. We did re-examine the multi-manager structure, reordered it a bit based upon what we learned over the years. And, you know, we'll be back with another conversation here as we do the annual refresh in June. So I'm going to pause there for any questions before we bring in Bryce Doty of SIT to kind of give us an update on his portfolio and the markets.
All right, I'm looking here in my side gallery. I do not see any hands up, Tim.
All right.
So I think we're good to bring in Bryce.
All right, if we can move Bryce over as a panelist. And Mitch, if you could stop sharing your screen.
There is Mr. Doty.
Hi, can everyone see and hear me?
We can see you, Bryce. Good morning.
Okay. Is my mic working?
Your mic is working.
All right, that's great. I'm at home logging into my computer at work, and my share screen function isn't going to work doing that. So I don't know, Mitch, if you can keep sharing your screen.
We can pull it up.
Pull it up from here.
Okay. That'd be great. I see my head's kind of getting cut off there. That's fantastic. Yeah, just as a prelude to the presentation, I recall when we first read in the RFP process, as we were going through the selection process, how much we sat around, we just loved the way that you were approaching investing in a pension plan differently than other pension plans. And by being more thoughtful about looking at, you know, what is the actual purpose of the plan? You know, you need to make claim payments, and you need to, you know, take care of the pension people collecting the checks so that you can have a portion of the portfolio to focus on the long-term growth. But the other element that I think so many plans maybe miss is that attention to the downside risk. And that liquidity portion of the portfolio being down 2.5% when core bonds are down 3 to 4 times that is amazing. And so if you look at the aggregate index, it's down about 9 right now, but it was down 10% at one point year to date. And it's not just the main thing is, yeah, being down 2.5 is way better than being down 10. But the secondary effect is if you're down 10 and you have to get back to where you were, you have to make 11% to get back to 10, right? Because you're at $90, and to get $90 back to $100, you know, that's tougher than if you're down 2.5 and you want to get back to 100. So the attention to the downside risk has multiple compounding effects. And I know it's not such a big deal since your plan has steadily, you know, improved its funding status, but you know, for other plans to not look at that downside risk is really, really dangerous, because then they just get stuck and can't ever get back. So we've been excited to be a part of the process and to see it, that the theory is one thing, but to see reality actually work as well as it has is pretty exciting. So just to dive into our experience, we've had good experience and still demand for our products. The third line here is shows the rankings for the short duration strategy that we use for your portfolio. The first column is 10-year annualized return. The second is the Sharpe's ratio. The next is the alpha. Right before the meeting, I saw a draft of this through March 31st. It takes a while for all the managers to dump all their data into the spreadsheets and all that. So it takes a while to get your ranking back out from it. And I thought, you know, we've had a tough quarter. The rankings for all three categories are still high. And in fact, they're all ones now, which I thought, man, what a horrible bond market. If we did so bad and everyone else did worse, what a tough period. But that having been said, I think for short duration strategies, 85% of the damage is done. I think even for the longer strategies like the aggregate index, 70% of that is done. And I'll explain why later. So if we can go to page 10, there you go, page 10. I already mentioned year to date looks terrible. We're down 3. It's largely due to the fact that we're in mortgage bonds, and mortgage bonds have had a very difficult time. The people thought that they had a short bond when they had mortgages that were steadily getting refinanced over and over and over. You're like, wow, you keep getting your money back really fast and having to reinvest it. So it's a very short bond. Now you've seen with mortgage rates go up to 5.25%. By the way, we think they'll peak at 6% in the fall. It's a dramatically different world than when mortgage rates were at 3. So all these people that had, you know, 3% and 4% mortgages are no longer refinancing. So as an investor, it was great getting all this cash flow in that you you could reinvest if rates are going up. And now you're not. You're stuck with what are now considered inferior coupons, and for an even longer period of time than you ever thought. So generically, I don't know, 70% maybe of the mortgage market is being hurt by that phenomenon. We are not. We benefit from that phenomenon because your average coupon is so high, we don't want anyone refinancing. Okay, this is good for mortgage rates to go up. Problem is there's guilt by association on a 1 to 2 quarter period when this happens initially, when there's an initial rush up in rates. We kind of saw this in the taper tantrum with Bernanke when he first talked about raising rates in the beginning of that rate cycle. So it tends to happen in the early part of a move up in rates. But now, you know, saying right now today, the yield on the portfolio is 3.1% and the duration is about 2.4. So it's refreshing to have a yield over the duration again. The aggregate index, core bond index, is still not so lucky. They're like 3.3% yield, and the duration is 6.5. I mean, it's still a terrible ratio of yield to interest rate risk. The reason that I want to focus on this is because this kind of tells you why I think the damage in the short duration part of the yield curve for everyone is 85% done. If you think about if you can buy a corporate bond, a mortgage bond, or something like that that has a 2-year maturity, and you can get probably 3.25% to 3.5% on that. Let's use 3.5 as a round number. Maybe rates have to go up just a little bit further to get that. But let's say it's 3.5%. And if you wait 1 year, you'll have earned 3.5% yield. Your bond at the end of a year will have a duration of 1. So it will take a 3.5 percentage point rise in the 1-year T-bill and 1-year corporate bonds or whatever sector you're in for that rise in rate to cause enough price decline to wipe out all of your income. People get pretty comfortable with that risk at a certain point. They're like, Friday, the 2-year hit 2.75 briefly and came right back down. Now it's back to 2.5. So the short end of the curve, it has a hard time going up much more, since people are so comfortable feeling that they can't really get hurt that bad if their yield can protect them from a really huge additional rise in rates. So that's a key thing to keep in mind. So you might have one more quarter of, you know, hard, bad returns in the short duration, and then basically it's going to have positive returns from this June going forward for quite a while. Another thing that we've done in this portfolio is we kind of dragged our feet getting the principal and interest reinvested. We knew as soon as Powell was going to get reappointed, he was going to do the Powell pivot just like he did the last time he was appointed and immediately start raising rates. So the last time he immediately raised rates up to 2.25% and then actually brought them down to 2.75 before the pandemic hit. And just true to form, he has immediately pivoted, said they're going to raise rates up. And going back to the Taylor rule conversation, where that oftentimes comes into play, granted it's used in multiple ways that Mitch talked about, but is the what's the neutral rate for the Fed? And they think it's between 2 to 2.5%. It's funny. In every cycle, that neutral rate kind of oozes out a bit as they raise rates. So, but it's always a somewhere between 2 and 3, and no one really knows. But the reason they use and talk about that so much is like, look, if you want to slow inflation, the very first thing you need to do is stop being stimulative. So you must be at a rate that is at least neutral. In other words, it's not stimulating, it's not restricting economic activity. So if we, I don't have anything more on the short duration strategy, because I mean, the key components are right there, except for the fact that the, here, go forward a couple pages just to see, I don't think it's in here, but the tips. So we've dragged our feet, you know, putting the cash work because of what we thought the Fed was going to do. We also thought inflation was just going to keep ratcheting up. Here, go keep going to one more page, I think. Oh, no, 3 more pages. I forgot this is the prepayment. Well, the second page of the outlook will help. Okay, so here, you know, Mitch already covered some of this, but the 2-year yield is the dark one, and that's the one that just shot up so far so fast. It's really hard for that to keep going at that rate because of what I just described in how you get to the point where you have enough income, investors are like, yeah, I'll be fine. When you're getting 0.25% on the 2-year, you know, and rates could go up 200 basis points, so you're going to get slaughtered. And that's why everyone panicked and ran for the door and caused the slaughter, actually. But we expected inflation to kind of persist. We'd never bought into the transitory argument. There's nothing in the transitory argument that had any validity to it. It was, you know, kind of hope. But we have a saying in the business, hope is not a strategy. So we had the cash that we've been collecting in principal interest, we put into really short tips. We're up to 8 to 9% in tips. They are doing really well now. The way the principal changes, or the way you get inflation protection in a tip, is the principal grows at the rate of non-seasonally adjusted CPI. So not the headline number that you look at. And it's month by month. So every month in the middle of the month, you get the CPI data. For this month of April, those tips are growing at a 11% annualized rate. We're getting almost a point growth in 1 month on a treasury bond. Next month, the non-seasonally adjusted number that we just got 10 trading days ago is 17%. 17% annualized. You're getting like 1.3 points of growth in the month of May. And so that's one way to try and protect, you know, add a little downside protection to the portfolio. Now in the third quarter, all of those numbers will start to come down and we'll start buying more of the mortgages. We also put some of that cash that's been coming in floating rate treasuries. So, you know, kind of hoping for the Fed to raise rates, because they'll reset immediately with the rise in Fed funds rate. With that, let's go through this fairly quickly, but jump in with questions at any time. Mitch covered a lot of this, so I don't really need to, but let's go page by page here, because I keep reordering the pages. The balance sheet, on May 4th, we're going to hear what the Fed wants to do with this. So they've accumulated and amassed the $9 trillion worth of treasuries and mortgages. And they accumulate it by, you know, printing money out of thin air. It's horrible policy. And they finally stopped doing that last month. And that's also what's hurt, you know, stocks and bonds, because they're not pumping in a massive amount of money every month. And now they're talking about actually reducing the amount of assets they have and shrinking the money supply. and they'll start hitting in June and July. And I think that's one reason that they won't be able to raise rates as fast as they think they can. And they won't be able to reduce this balance sheet by as much as they think they can. They've hinted that they'll reduce this $1 trillion a year. I don't think they have any idea how problematic that is. They live in a world of theory, and theory works great in theory. In practice, it's a whole nother matter. And they're going to find that out in the second and third quarter, that they're going to have to go a little bit slower than they anticipate. We expect $500 trillion reduction in balance sheet a year with, and eventually they'll want to get rid of all their mortgages and only hold treasuries. Let's go to the next page. This is the fiscal cliff. If you look at the red on the bottom, it shows that the federal government had, was spending a lot during the pandemic, and they're not going to be spending as much. That's going to create a huge headwind for 2023. You'll start to see it this year, but it's masked by the huge amount of pent-up excess savings that people have that is keeping demand propped up. But it's a $2 to $3 trillion reduction in money being spent on goods and services. So GDP measures the incremental change in goods and services. And this is what people mean when they say the fiscal cliff. They mean there's $2 to $3 trillion less going to be spent on goods and services for the next 12 months. Next page. So that's another headwind for the Fed. That's why I also think they can't do what they think they're going to do. Let's go to the next page here. The personal savings rate, this needs to go negative. We need to burn off the excess savings for people to go back to work. They need to start paying rent, pay their student loan payments. Good thing my four recently graduated kids between my wife and I can't hear that. But but it's true. They need to start making the payments. It changes your attitude, okay, about work. Let's go to the next page. Keep going. Mitch helped me with so much of this. The inflation expectation is what this page is supposed to measure, and it's up to 3, but it's weird because that's over 10 years. Over 1 year, if you ask people what 1 year will be, they'll be like, it's going to be gigantic. The negative yield, the negative coupon yield on a short tip is about 10%. So for a tip maturing 6 months, let's say, that means that people think inflation is going to be at least 5% in 6 months or 10% annualized. So that's the key thing, is that for the very, very short term, yes, there's massive inflation pressures that the Fed can do nothing about. Them raising rates does not get people to go back to work to rectify the supply shortages and the labor shortages. That was a federal fiscal issue the Fed can't really do anything about. But they feel a lot of pressure to do something about it, and they will. So let's keep going to what I think the path of what the Fed is going to do. All right, keep going. We kind of know inflation is high in the short end. Keep going here through here. The point of this page is like, just don't own tips all the time. Never just put those in there all the time, because you're paying excess insurance premium. You just want to use tips every now and then, because the orange line is always above the blue line. That means that over the long run, you're losing money on tips versus regular treasuries. You can go to the next page here. That's kind of the same thing. If there's seasonal effects of non-seasonal CPI, they're great in the spring, not good in the fall. All right, so keep going. This is kind of critical that, early in the pandemic, the amount of stimulus that was thrown out there kind of sort of matched the amount of money people weren't earning by not going to work to be able to buy goods and services. So in a low CPI inflation environment, you can have worker productivity more than make up for the rise in costs. And so companies can pay them more, and you can have real wage growth after inflation. And this is the number one, two, three, four, five reasons that the Fed has a mandate of keeping inflation low, purely for this phenomenon, that if inflation gets up over two, the productivity of workers cannot keep up, and you have declining real wages. That's the only reason. Okay, go to the next page. But if you go and you just give everyone a whole bunch of money and you don't increase the amount of goods and services for that money to be spent on, everything just costs more. And that's what we experienced the next round. You know, they just kept on doing stimulus payments. After a certain point, there was just too much. So as a result, now the wage growth, as huge as it is, I mean, there's stunning increase in wages. It's still trailing CPI because companies have to cover not just labor costs, they have to cover material costs too. So by definition, the amount that they're paying the labor is can't keep up with both unless labor becomes dramatically, stunningly more productive overnight, and it can't keep up. So this is what's freaking out the Fed. They're like, okay, we're failing. We need to really, really raise rates. We need to do it fast. The Taylor rule says we should be at 3. We're at 0.25%. We got to crank things into high gear. So let's go, keep going. Home prices just annoy me. The home price appreciation is not included in CPI. They use what it would cost to rent your home, which is completely dumb. Because it understates CPI. See, actual inflation that people are experiencing is way worse than CPI. All right, keep going. And that's the difference. Look at that red line. It says 4%. Oh, everyone knows real estate is 20% increase in value. Okay, keep going. Getting close here. Okay, so I'm just going to end on this page. This is what we think the rate increases are going to be. We tweaked it 25 basis points between what we thought was going to happen last October, November. And when we came out with it then, everyone thought we were insane, that there's no way that the Fed could raise rates this high. Now people think that it's not aggressive enough. I disagree with both. I think it was right then, it's right now, okay? Because they did 25 basis points in March. That's because there's so much leverage in the system. Okay, we have some funds that use leverage and we're borrowing at 15 basis points. I mean, it's just so cheap that we knew there just had to be lots of. So you're going to let the air out of the balloon. You got to do it a little bit slowly. So that's why they started with just 0.25%. It's not because they're dumb. It's not because they know 0.25% isn't going to make a dent, right? But it was because all the leverage in the system and you saw how horrible this year's been. It's like the worst year in 40 years. And so now a lot of that unwinding of the leverage is gone. And that's another reason the worst of the damage in the short end is over. And Powell has consistently pushed back against anyone saying that he's going to do the same amount at every meeting. So it has to vary, right? So we have some variability here. We're going to have 50 basis points in a couple weeks. Another 50 basis points in June, they at least get rates to 1.25. If Greenspan was in office, he would have done 1% right off the bat. It's like, look, you got to do something. And he wouldn't have waited for a meeting. Yeah. But the way things are so politicized with the Fed now, they're a little bit dysfunctional. And so this is the path that they're going to take. And then reporters going to be like, oh, so you're just going to do 0.5% for every meeting. And Powell, you can see him just bristle. He just can't stand it when everyone says that it's going to be the same every meeting. So I'm like, all right, he's going to throw them off. There's going to be something bad. You know, Ukraine and Russia, I haven't even talked about that. You know, the fiscal cliff we talked about, there could be higher corporate taxes. There's, savings are running off. Inflation is burning through people's savings and stuff. So something's going to happen. When they reduce the balance sheet, they're going to be like, okay, maybe if we're going to be reducing the balance sheet, maybe we don't do a 50 basis point increase. You know, and we see how the balance sheet reduction is going, if it causes the stock market to crack, you know. So that's why we have a couple of 25 basis point moves in there. And then in November, they'll say, all right, we're at neutral. We're going to go to neutral. and see how it goes. We're going to get 50 basis points, and this is our Taylor rule, whatever they use. And they're going to say, we're kind of in the neutral range, and take a breather, because it's market's going to have a hard time. Okay. Stock market's going to really be bumpy. People are going to be forecasting a much slower growth for 23. We're forecasting a very brief recession in the second half of 23. It will be a very healthy, a very necessary readjustment and to get back to a more normal equilibrium in our economy, because I don't know if you've seen on the West Coast where you guys are at, Prologis is a warehouse REIT, and they're just exploding, and companies are ordering excess inventory just like they did in the 80s, where they're like, hey, every month that goes by, our inventory is worth more money. We have positive carry. That's happening again. There's going to be a glut next year. So it's so that's why there will be a very short recession. That's not like a normal recession where, okay, everything's just really in the toilet. It'll be just kind of, hey, we got over our skis a little bit on the inventory thing. We need to kind of readjust that. And that will also kill inflation. All the inflation worries we have today will be completely gone a year from now. We'll be like, I don't think there's much left. So it's, that's all I got.
All right. Let me see, Bryce, if we have, I see Jerry, your hand's up. Go ahead, please.
Bryce, a couple of questions. There are so many talking heads out there, it's tough to keep track of them all. But there was a forecast by someone recently, one of the financial institutions, well-regarded recently, saying that the, you know, we're surely looking at a recession. And now today they've upgraded that to say, it's going to be a terrible recession. It's going to be twice as bad as we thought it was going to be. I just, that kind of clickbait drives me crazy trying to watch this thing. And the other thing is that there was discussion as little as a year ago that the new Fed or the new minimum wage should be $15 an hour. And now the first person has come out and suggested, nope, it should be 30. And so that's going to be the new bogey. And I'm thinking to myself, if people want to pay $12 a dozen for eggs and $20 for a Big Mac, that's a really good way to go. Otherwise, lighten up. So what are your thoughts on that, if any?
Yeah, as far as the talking heads go, everyone thinks that, you know, it's going to be maybe a mild recession, but you can't get anyone to cover you or put you on TV or quote you. So they keep one-upping each other. It's just like the expectation for what the Fed rate increases are going to be. Everyone's like, Goldman had to beat Merrill Lynch's estimate, you know, and they're all trying to get out ahead just to get some press. And it's goofy. I mean, we make money off it. Okay. So while I laugh at it, we take advantage of that misinformation and volatility, but I can see why it just drive you nuts, because they're the press only covers the most extreme estimates. And so that's why you get that phenomenon. And yet in reality, the consensus data for growth is not for a severe recession. So they're only covering the most extreme. There's just so much demand right now in the system. I mean, look at how much people want to travel. It's just crazy how that demand will have to probably peak at 125% for airline travel, 125% of what it was in 2019, which probably happened over the summer, before it starts to come back down. So, and then what was the other piece that you said?
It was about, the clickbait about minimum wage.
Oh, yeah. So
it should be at least 30. And I'm thinking, why not 50? Why not 100?
Right. If it was that easy, it would have been done already. Okay. Yeah, the world's been in existence for a long time. If it's that easy to solve all the problems just by jacking in, you know, obviously it doesn't work. And we're seeing that there's finally a sentiment shift where the light bulb is starting to go off. There's a lot of resistance now to that, saying, look, the wage inflation is part of the problem. We need to get that under control, because companies are at will raising prices. They are increasing their margins by just saying, well, we got to pay our people more. you know, you want better wages, right? And people are starting to catch on that that's a net lose for everyone. So it's a really interesting psychological phenomenon. I just first saw that beginning this year. I mean, having come through the investment world in the 80s, that was just obvious to everyone. And then to see that sentiment go, you know, where, and that's why McDonald's always paid more than the minimum. Well, to see all of that kind of history and knowledge and understanding get reversed over the last 5 to 7 years is like, well, that's a temporary phenomenon. It just, after a while, everyone kind of goes back to realizing, yeah, that's a lose-lose. And so you still are seeing what you're saying happen, but it's not getting the same kind of support behind it. There's very few places that are wanting to do more stimulus because they're like, wait, no, that's just going to make the inflation worse. And polls are showing that people are freaking out about inflation. So I don't see those kind of, it's like the people that are doing the clickbait for the $30, they're almost trying to, you know, get the people that are against it to click. So that's my take on it, Amy.
Interesting. Any other questions for Bryce? Well, as usual, that was fascinating, Bryce. It's a journey.
Well, I apologize for that because the bond guy is supposed to put you to sleep.
No, it's too interesting to go, you know, to go to sleep. None of us really understand what you said, but it is very interesting.
Oh, good. Well, at least I accomplished that goal.
All right. I don't see any other hands up. So thank you, Bryce. Informative as always, Tim and Mitch, really, really, really great stuff. This is, it's fascinating, even to the degree we can understand it, right? It's all good stuff.
Well, thank you all again and have a great day.
All right, Bryce. Be well.